father and a son rat were trailing the scent of a tasty morsel in the big city when all of a sudden from behind a bunch of crates jumped out the most ferocious alley cat they'd ever seen and began to chase them. Father and son were running for their lives and they knew that the end was coming and there was only one hope. There was a manhole cover with a little hole in it and they beat the alley cat to the hole. They scampered downside and they found themselves in the sewer where they sat. And they sat. And they sat. In fact, they sat there all day. And by nightfall, the sun rat couldn't contain himself any longer. And he said to his father, he said, "I'm getting hungry. Do you think the cat may have left by now?" And the father said, "Yes, son, I think it's probably safe to go out now." So the young rat began to immediately scurry up the hole to try to get out. When the father rat grabbed it by the tail and pulled the son back down and said, "Now wait just a minute, son. Before you go out, I need to check." And so the father rat cleared his throat and let out the biggest bark you've ever heard in your life. To which the alley cat, which was perched above the manhole cover, let out a squeal and ran away. The son observed all this and said, "Man, Dad, that was awesome." And they climbed up out of the sewer together and they were standing there looking around. And the son turned to the dad and said, "Dad, where in the world did you learn to talk like that?" And the dad rat said to the son rat, "Son, if you're going to live in the city, it's a good thing to know a second language." Now, the first time I told that story to my wife, she laughed. And I said, "Do you think that's funny?" And while she was laughing, she said, "Yeah, I do." She said, "Do you think that's funny?" I said, "Not at all." She says, "Well, if you tell it and it bombs, what are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I'll just go on and make the point that I'm trying to make then. So let me go ahead and make the point because that story's not funny to me." In the world in which we live, learning a second language is a difficult thing. Now, how many of you here speak a second language fluently? Raise your hand. You're fluent. Okay, not very many. Okay. How many of you at some point along the way attempted to learn a second language? Raise your hand. Whoa. Why is it that so many people attempt and fail? You know, there's a reason. And the reason is that in the process of learning a second language, you go through some stages. The first stage you go through is the mimic stage. It's when you associate a sound in a foreign language, a language you don't know, you associate it with an object. And when you mimic that sound or you repeat that sound, people who know that other language smile at you and it feels kind of fun. It feels real good. You know, my son walks around the house saying things like, "Verde." Well, the only thing I know about verde is it's good on enchiladas, right? Roja. I mean, he's got a couple of those things down. He can say them. Then you move on to the more difficult stage, which is the translation stage. And that's when you've got enough of the language down where you actually can hear someone speaking or you can see some of it written. And when you see it, you take it into your mind. You translate it into your native tongue, English. It makes sense to you. Then you formulate your answer in English, and then you try to translate it back into whatever language you're speaking, Spanish or French or German or Russian or Chinese, whatever, and then you speak that out. Well, that's a several-step process. You have to hear, translate it into your language, formulate an answer, translate it back, and speak it out. And that's where most people fail in learning a second language, and you know why? Because it's so much easier just to resort back to your native tongue. Just to say it the way it comes natural. And what I would suggest to you is that every single person is born with a native language, so to speak. In other words, there's something native to us that is so natural to us that it's hard to learn anything different. When I'm talking about a native language, I'm not talking about a tongue or a language that we speak. I'm talking about a lifestyle or a way we look at the world. And what I would suggest is most of us, from the time we're born, or all of us from the time we're born, we learn to speak the language known as the language of me. In other words, everything in life comes through the grid of how does it affect me? Does this make me happy? Does this make me sad? Does this better my station in life? Does this lower my station in life? How is it going to benefit me? And we grow up, we learn that language, and everything that we do is filtered through that language. And every once in a while, we'll make an attempt to step out of that, and we'll try to step into the language of maybe serving others. But that's difficult, because we've got to hear it, we've got to translate it into how is it going to affect me, then we translate it back into how should I respond, and that becomes hard. So oftentimes, we resort back to the world revolves around me, everything's about me, and then a person comes to faith in Jesus Christ. And all of a sudden, God asks us to learn a new language. It's called the language of faith. It is so unnatural. It's so opposite. Because God tells us in the language of faith that everything that has to do with faith is exactly opposite of the way I would normally think. For example, Jesus makes these strange statements. Like he says, if anyone would save his life, he's got to lose it. What do you mean? How can that be? You know, the language of me says that the way I save my life is to carefully protect myself in every situation. And Jesus is saying, no. The way you're going to actually save your life, the language of faith, is to abandon yourself, to lose your life, to give it up, to die to self. And oftentimes we'll make a small venture into learning the language of faith, but it feels really unnatural, so we resort back to me. This is about me. Jesus teaches this lesson to his disciples over and over and over again until they finally get it. And it would do us good to keep studying it until we learn the language of faith. And I want you to see a particular passage where he really teaches the language of faith. And that's in Mark chapter 6. Probably one of the most well-known stories in all the Bible. In fact, it appears in all four Gospels. It's the story of the feeding of the 5,000. So if you'll turn, excuse me, did I say Matthew? I meant Mark. Turn to Mark chapter 6. You can find it in Matthew, but let's look at the section in Mark chapter 6. That's where we want to go today. And to give you a little bit of a preamble to what actually happens in the passage, you notice in verse 30, it says the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all that they had done and taught. Now what has taken place prior to this? If you were to go back and look at chapter 6, you would see that this is involved in the Galilean ministry where Jesus is in the north and his disciples have been selected, they've been commissioned, and they've been sent out to actually do the work of the ministry. So Peter and James and John and all the disciples are actually going out. Apart from Jesus, they're doing ministry, and they're coming back and they're reporting to Jesus the incredible success that they've experienced in doing ministry. Now I want you to notice in verse 12, it says, they went out and they preached that people should repent. They drove out many demons and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. In other words, you can see them going out, and now they're coming back with their report. And Peter's saying, Jesus, you know, we ran into this one guy in this small village, and he was the village skeptic. He was completely an agnostic, and we thought, there's no way that he will ever accept the good news of the kingdom. But you know, as we began to share with him about who you are and what you came to do, it was like, all of a sudden, something happened. Something began to change. The guy began to soften. We would have never believed it, but you know what? He embraced the message of the gospel of the kingdom. You just, Jesus, you would have had to be there to see it. You couldn't believe what transpired. And Andrew's telling the story. You know, we went into this one house, and while we were in this house, we were trying to share it with these people, the good news of the message of your coming. And they were saying, well, you know, we don't really feel too positive toward God right now because we've got a daughter who's dying of an incurable illness. And how could God let that happen to us? And Andrew said, Jesus, you know what? We said, is it okay if we pray for your daughter? And so we began to pray for her, and God miraculously healed her right there. And all the family came to faith. And so here are the disciples on their first ministry encounter. They're coming back in verse 30, and they're reporting to Jesus all that they had done, all that they had seen, and all that God had done in a miraculous way to cause their ministry to be fruitful. And so when we pick up in verse 30, they give their report, and verse 31 says, then because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, come with me by yourself to a quiet place and get some rest. One of the things that you'll always observe is wherever the power of God is being displayed, there will always be a crowd of people. When people begin to find out that God is working, that God is moving, more people keep coming. And the apostles, the disciples are out preaching. So many people are coming that the crowds are gathering. More people are coming. It says they literally didn't have time to even eat. It's like they're out there teaching and they're preaching. And the line of people that want to come and talk to them, want to be prayed for, is getting longer and longer and longer. And so by the time that they finish with the last person, it's midnight. They haven't had a chance to eat. They realize that they missed lunch. They missed dinner. They go to bed that night. They get up the next morning. And before they even have a chance to scramble the eggs, there's a crowd of people coming again. And these guys are approaching what we would call burnout. I mean, they're just exhausted. People keep coming. God's at work. Miracles are happening. The crowds are relentless. The ministry goes on and on and on. And so what does Jesus say? Jesus says, come with me by yourself to a quiet place. We'll get some rest. So Jesus is going to take them on a vacation. They're going to leave ministry. They're going to take a vacation. They're going to get some rest together. Notice what happens in verse 32. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. Now what you need to know is that they get in the boat to cross the big lake. It's 4 miles across the lake by boat. It's 10 miles around the lake by foot. When the people see them getting in the boat to leave, the people begin, the passage says, to run. Now this is pre-Reebok, pre-ASIC. I mean, these sandal days, the people began to run because they know they're going to the other side of the lake. They begin to run to get there. And as they begin to go, they pick up a bigger crowd along the way. When they come to the first small village or the first group of people that are there on the lake fishing, where are you guys going in such a hurry? Well, Jesus and the disciples are going to the other side of the lake. Can we come with you? Absolutely. And so this big crowd is coming and they're running on foot. And when they get around the lake, what happens to the disciples is they're on this leisurely cruise across the lake and they get to the other side. And when they get to the other side, there's a whole crowd of people. And I don't know about you, but I'm thinking to myself, like, what in the world? I thought we were going to get a rest. I thought we were going to get a vacation. I thought we were going to get a break. And you know what Jesus does? I mean, leave it to Jesus. Look what he does. Verse 34, when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. Jesus, you're supposed to be spending time with us. We've been working our fingers to the bone doing ministry. We need a break. What are you thinking about? And so what do? Verse 35, by this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. This is a remote place, they said, and it's already very late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. Now here's what I would call a reasonable approach to life and ministry. A reasonable approach to life and ministry. Jesus, they say to Jesus, hey, we've done all that we can for these people. Man, we're pushing into the evening. We don't have any food for them. They didn't bring food. They were running to get here. They didn't plan ahead. We didn't plan ahead. We don't have any banquet facilities out here. Send them into the villages so that they can buy food. It doesn't make any sense that we would keep up this pace long term. And so the reasonable, rational, normal thing to do is say, enough is enough. Send them away. Send them back. Let them go. We've done all that we can to help these people. Another thing you have to know in the culture is that when they go back into the towns and villages, the chances of them actually finding any bread to buy is probably pretty slim. Now, it's a better probability that they'll find bread in the village than they will out in the wilderness. No question about that. But in that culture, they baked bread in the morning and usually sold most of it by noon. So to have a large crowd this large trying to go back and find food, chances are it wasn't going to happen. You know, no IHOP or Golden Corral around the corner with an unlimited supply of carbohydrates just available for your consumption. They probably were going to go hungry anyway, but the disciples said, you know, they've got a better chance of getting the food back there than they do here. Now Jesus, again, moves them from speaking the language of me Like, what can I do? I've done all I can for these people to speaking the language of faith. And I want you to see the faith approach to life and ministry. Here's the faith approach to life and ministry. In verse 36, 37, but he answered, you give them something to eat. The reasonable thing is to send them home. The faith thing is you give them something to eat. Jesus says, you give them something to eat. And notice, they said to him, that would take 8 months of a man's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat? That's a very, very profound statement. And I want you to understand where these guys are coming from. When they answer the question, you give them something to eat, there's two parts to their answer. Number one is, we don't have the money. We don't have the money. We don't have the resources to feed these people. But the second one, which is, I think, even more profound, is they say, even if we did, would we spend it on bread? And I think that that's a very profound question. See, they're asking the question, would we take all this money, 8 months of wages, and would we waste it on buying bread for one meal for these people? That would be a waste of money, wouldn't it, Jesus? How could we be so extravagant to take that money and give it away? In other words, they're saying two things. One, about when I look at me, I'm inadequate. But when I also look at me, I have to ask the question, would I waste my net worth buying bread for these people? The difference between Jesus and the disciples here is that Jesus does not look and see bread. Jesus looks and he sees people. When Jesus looks at them, he says, you give these people something to eat. You feed the people. And when they look at it, they say, oh, this is about bread. And it's very interesting because oftentimes we think of the same thing when we're in the process of looking at expanding our facilities. You know, someone says, would we spend $16 million on a building? We say, no, we would never spend $16 million on a building. Would we spend $16 million to further reach this community with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Absolutely. Because from God's standpoint, the money is not an issue. From our standpoint, the money is a huge issue. From our standpoint, when we speak the language of me, we're constantly asking the question, well, if I invest the resources that God has given me, how will that affect me? What will that do to me? How will that hinder what I want? That's the language of me, my native tongue. And Jesus says, I want you to speak the language of faith. The language of faith is God's got all the resources in the world. He gave you the ones He's got given you. And if He wants you to invest some of them, He's going to take care of that. Where we look and we see bread, where we look and we see bricks, God looks and He sees people. And He says, you give them something to eat. And they say, even if we had 8 months' wages, we couldn't do that. You see, to them, it's always about the money, how it affects me. To Him, it's about the people, faith versus me. So notice what happens there. In verse 38, He says, how many loaves do you have? You say, you don't have anything to offer? How many loaves do you have? Go and see. Go find out what you really have. And the response is incredible. When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fishes. And we find out from the other passages that they actually, as they began to interact with the crowd, there was a little boy there that had planned ahead, or at least his mother had. He had 5 little biscuits and 2 sardines. And they bring that to Jesus. Now, I don't know about you guys, but man, if I'm the little boy, I'm thinking the language of me. Like, what are these people thinking? Didn't their mother think ahead? Like, I brought my lunch, and why will my 5 loaves and 2 fishes, my little sardines and biscuits, why would that do any good in this large crowd? You know what? I'm going to kind of go over here behind this big rock, and I'm going to eat my lunch and worry about these people later. The other thing I wonder is, in a crowd this big, don't you think there was at least one other person that planned ahead? Do you think that, like, type A personalities are just in this century? I mean, there had to be one other obsessive person that was thinking, you know, we've got to plan ahead, but you don't see anybody else coming forward with food. Maybe that's why Jesus said, if you want to learn the lesson of faith and the language of faith, you need to look to little children. Because it's just amazing how little children have the ability to trust and big old grown-up adults who've seen God work millions of times don't have that same faith. The little boy brings his lunch. They get the bread and the fish, and here's the miracle. Verse 39 says, "Then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties, taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish. And looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to his disciples to set before the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied, and the disciples picked up 12 baskets full of broken pieces of bread and fish, and the number of men who had eaten was 5,000. Large group of people to feed on a very small budget. Martha Stewart would be proud. Jesus does this absolutely incredible miracle here. And I believe that there are 3 lessons that we can learn in speaking the language of faith, because this is the language that God calls us all to. The first lesson is we speak the language of faith when we embrace our responsibility to reach people. When we embrace our responsibility to reach people. Jesus turns to these guys and says to them, "You give them something to eat." Now, why did he do that? Why wouldn't they say, "Jesus, we've given all. Like, we've missed meals for these people. We have worked so hard for them that we even haven't even had time to eat. You're more worried about feeding them than you are about feeding us." And Jesus is saying, "Hey, you know, about the time you speak the language of me is when you start thinking, what am I getting out of this deal? How is this going to benefit me? What's this going to do for me? That's the language of me." Jesus calls them to take personal responsibility for these people. The reasonable approach would say, "You know, I've done enough. I've invested mine. I've given all. You know, I don't need to do anymore. I've given enough." But Jesus says we have a responsibility to reach people. And Jesus says to the congregation of Hill Country Bible Church, to each of us, when it comes to the community that we live in and the spiritual hunger that's here, Jesus says to us, "You give them something to eat." We say, "Jesus, well, that's going to cost." He says, "You're right, it's going to cost. You give them something to eat." We have a responsibility to reach people the life-changing reality of Jesus Christ. We all do. And the question is, are we participating in that? You see, Jesus is calling them to take ownership of the gospel message. Jesus is calling them to take ownership of the people at their charge. Jesus is calling them to move away from simply thinking, "I've got mine, and that's all I need. Let the rest worry about the rest." Now, immediately following this story, there's just this absolutely incredible story about Jesus walking on the water. And I want to really quickly go over this with you because this is an incredibly powerful story. Verse 45, Jesus puts him on the boat, sends him across the water, and he stays behind to pray. Verse 47 says, "When evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. About the 4th watch of the night, he went out to them walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and he said, 'Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid.' Then he climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened." Now, that last verse really bothers me. They had just seen this incredible miracle, the feeding of the 5,000. And yet it said they didn't learn the lesson from that story. Their hearts were hardened, which indicates to me that it is possible for me to be standing in the middle of a miracle and miss the point. Have you ever stood in the middle of a miracle and missed the point? You know what? You probably wouldn't know it if you did. Right? That's the point. If your hearts are hardened, you don't see it. These guys are standing in the middle of the miracle and they missed the point. The question is, what is the point that they missed? Which brings me to the second phrase in this passage that bothers me. I want you to notice at the end of verse 48, he said, he was about to pass by them. The word there is he intended
to pass by them. In other words, here's the scene. These guys are in the boat. They're rowing like crazy. The wind, the storm, they're about ready to lose it. They feel... Now, these are fishermen. If it's bad for them, they know it's bad. They're in a bad spot, and they look over, and they see this figure, which they take as a ghost because he's walking on the water. And he's walking on the water, but he's not just walking on the water. He's walking by them. He's leaving them there. And they begin to cry out. He stops. He comes back. He gets into the boat. And the wind and the waves and the sea are calm. Now, what's also interesting is of the times this miracle is recorded, the walking on the water, this is the only occurrence where this phrase, he would have passed them by or he intended to go by them, is used. You know, this is also the story where Peter actually got out of the boat and began to come toward Jesus. Interestingly enough, Mark is a disciple of Peter. Mark is recording Peter's account of this situation, and what Peter leaves out is his heroic act of faith, stepping out and walking on the water. What Peter leaves in, that he thinks is important, is that when Jesus got back in the boat, they dawned on them, that was Jesus and he was going to leave us out here. You see the point? The crowd needs help. And Jesus gives them spiritual food, and he turns to the disciples and says, give them physical food. The disciples say, send them away. Jesus ministers to the disciples and he gives them spiritual food. And in the middle of their struggle on the sea, Jesus lets them know that I could just walk by and leave you people here. And if I did that, I would be mimicking the very same behavior, the very same language of me that you guys had with the crowd. The question is, if Jesus had the same compassion on you that you have on other lost people, would you have a prayer? If Jesus had only invested in you what you're willing to invest to see the gospel spread, would you have a prayer? If it wasn't for Jesus committing 100%, giving everything, we wouldn't have a relationship with God. Do we take that and turn around and become self-focused? When Jesus calls on us, you give them something to eat? Or do we respond in the same way that Jesus responded on our behalf? That's the language of faith. The second message or lesson learned in this passage is that we speak the language of faith when we bring what we have to be used by Him. When we bring what we have to be used by Him. In their mind, unless you have 8 months' wages, we have nothing to offer here. And what Jesus said is, just bring me what you got. Just bring me what you got. That's all he asked for. Go see what you got and bring me what you got. And they bring him 5 biscuits and 2 sardines. And the result of that is Jesus does an incredible miracle. And oftentimes we look at what we have to offer in relationship to the incredible need. And we say, what I have, my part, what I can do is so small. It's really not worth it at all. It means a lot to me. It doesn't mean that much in the total scope of things. So why would I invest? Why would I give up my time? Why would I give up my resources? Why would I share the gospel? I don't think that it's going to make that much difference in the world. And Jesus says, don't worry about that. You bring what you have, and I'll do something incredible with it. You know, I've seen this happen over and over and over again. I'll tell you one story real quickly. In our last giving campaign, when we built this worship center, a guy shared a story about how he was praying about what he ought to give, and one of the things that he looked at was the possibility of giving some stock options. And, you know, he had some stock options through his company, and he was going to exercise those and give them. And when he looked at the price of the stock, he said, you know, I wouldn't even exercise these stock options for myself. The stock was so depressed at the time, he just said, I just don't feel like I should do this. And so he continued to pray. And over the next 3 weeks, you know what happened? You know what happened, don't you? The stocks began to increase in value. They increased to the point where he felt like This is a great price for the stock. I would exercise them for myself. And then they increased another dollar over that 3 weeks. He exercised options, bought the stock, gave it, and the very next day, within 24 hours, the stock prices dropped significantly back down to the levels they were at before. Are you saying, Tim, are you trying to tell me that God moved a Fortune 500 company up on the Dow Jones average just because one guy was praying? So that would be a miracle. It's kind of like taking five biscuits and two sardines and feeding 5,000 people. Why would you think that God couldn't do a miracle in your life? If you had a heart and you were willing to pray and say, God, use me. Use what I have. May not be much, but take what I have and use it. Seeing a miracle take place. Which brings us to our third lesson that we learn. And that is, when we speak the language of faith, when we believe that we will always receive more than we give. We believe that we will always receive more than we give. The language of faith says, serve, give, live it out. Go beyond the point of exhaustion for whatever God calls me to do. And the reality is in the process, we end up getting more than we ever give. I want you to see what they got. First of all, they got their meal. Verse 42, it says, all ate and were satisfied. So the disciples who had not even had time to eat now get a full stomach. In addition to that, they got to see a miracle. Haven't you ever wondered how that worked? You know, he's got these five biscuits and he's filling up these baskets. I mean, wouldn't you actually want to have been there looking at it to see how it happened? You know, did the biscuits keep growing? You know, while he was breaking the bread, did he have one small biscuit and he kept breaking it in half and the other half kept showing up there? I don't know what happened, but the disciples got to actually see it. They were part of it. In addition to that, he had the disciples distribute the food. Can you imagine them walking through, carrying these baskets of food, distributing it to people? And what are the people saying? They're patting them on the back saying, man, you guys are just awesome. Okay, Peter, man, you're a great guy. Look what you guys have done. Not only have you been willing to teach us, you're also willing to feed us. And how do you do this? And don't you think Peter was feeling really good? I mean, doesn't it make you feel full of joy when you know that you're part of a church, that you're seeing people come to faith? People are growing. They hear the stories and you go, man, I'm part of this thing. I get to be part of it. So not only did they get to see the miracle, they got to be part of the people who actually got involved in getting patted on the back, being part of something worthwhile. But not only that, Jesus does one more thing for them. It says in verse 43, and the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. Now every Jewish man would carry a wicker basket on the sash around his waist, and in that wicker basket, he would carry his daily provisions. It was kind of his lunchbox. No fast food restaurants, so you kind of packed your lunch in the morning or your food, and you ate it as you went along. So all of the disciples walk away with a full lunchbox, a full doggy bag, which was more than what they started out with. And I wonder why there was 12. Could it be that Jesus wanted each of the 12 disciples to understand that they would never give more to God than what they would get in return? You'll never serve me in a way that takes more away from you than what you get back. And the net result is they all went away blessed. We participate in God's miracles when we speak the language of faith. And Jesus Christ calls on them to give them something to eat and takes what little they have and does an incredible miracle through them. And at Hill Country Bible Church, we've seen Jesus Christ do incredible miracles through us. For those who are willing to step forward and be part of it, you actually participate in the miracle. And we've seen God reach this community, share the gospel, and impact people with the life-changing reality of Jesus Christ. And that's what we're doing, and that's why we're doing it. And that's the exclusive reason why we're doing it. And that's what Jesus calls us to do and calls us to be part of. And the question is, what language do you speak? Have you learned a second language? I know some people struggle. They say, you know, I've been through this before, and I've already done my part. That's just exactly what the disciples said. Hey, we've done our part. Send them away. Let somebody else do it. Some people said, well, you know, I don't know. This is a big step for me. If I invest in God's kingdom am I going to do okay? And all I can say is learn the lesson of the loaves. When Jesus Christ moves and you speak His native tongue, the miracles that happen in your life will be incredible as God works through you. And this morning we've given you a little gift, something to remember. If you'll take out of your eternal perspective this little envelope that says The Great Investment, inside there's a little card. Once you get this little card out, inside is a little card. It looks kind of like a credit card. Actually, it's a debit card. Okay? And it says that it's valid from today, and the expiration is Christ's return. Here's why we're giving you this card. We want you to stick this card someplace where you keep things that, you know, you might use for credit. And stick it in there as a reminder that every day of my life, I'm drawing on the gracious goodness of my God. Forgiveness, breath, resources, joy, opportunity. And this card is a reminder that Jesus Christ has given us all that we need and supplies our needs. And stick that in a prominent place where you can look at it. And over the next 36 months as we go through our commitment time, this will remind you of the true source of all giving, that we're getting something from Jesus Christ every day. In addition to that, we put in your pledge cards. And in an act of worship, what we're going to do now is just take a moment for those of you who are prepared and ready before God to make your financial commitment to Him. And we're going to bring them down and lay them at the front as an act of worship. So just come down from your seats and then go back to your seats. And what I'd like everybody to do is just stand up. We're going to sing some worship songs together and bring your commitment cards down and place them on the altar. You can come right now.